Hi, today's lecture will be about Haskell's type clauses, and so there was already one lecture by Eric Maurer, or based on a chapter from this book. He was speaking about type clauses, I think. I think this is chapter 10. So today's lecture is really meant to be like a deep dive into type clauses, so we're going to deal with some more sophisticated issues surrounding type clauses. And one particular goal I've set up for today is, as I announced last time, I want to solve the expression problem with type clauses. And then another thing is, I also want to kind of draw a comparison between type clauses of Haskell and interfaces of C# or Java. Yeah, so let's get started with the type clause primer, so that we are on the same page, but, you know, there's also some basic material in here. Well, so this is an example of a type clause. This is the type clause eq for equality. It basically captures the operation equals here for equality. So given two a's, whatever the type a might be in the end, like booleans, integers, expression, we compute a bool. Right, so this is how a type clause looks like. It's basically a declaration which gives a name to the type clause. And we also have a type parameter for the instantiating type eventually, and then we can refer to the type parameter in the function signatures, you know, in the operations that we want to provide for types that are going to instantiate this type class. Okay, so let's then define a quality for expressions. So this is our expression type we used last time, for the expression problem. So it's like there's constant expressions and there are addition expressions. Addition expressions are recursively defined on top of other expressions, right? So we want to define quality for this type just to understand how type clauses work. Yes, and then since we have two expression forms and, you know, equality is a binary operation, what we need to do is we need to look into all combinations of expression forms. So if you have a constant and add term, they can't be equal. Vice versa, if you have add and const, they can't be equal. If you have like two const terms, well, we still have to check the integers. And so if they are equal, then, you know, the const terms are equal. And then if you have two add terms, well, we have to recursively check equality for the sub-expressions of addition, right? So this is how it works. Someone defines a type clause, you define an algebraic data type, and eventually you realize you need to instantiate this or that type clause, and then you do this by a type clause instance. By the way, this is the full E clause, so I haven't shown you everything in the beginning. So the full E clause actually has two members, has an equality operation and an inequality operation. And it also provides the false for the two operations, like, you know, it defines inequality in terms of equality and negation, and likewise for equality. So this is interesting insofar because with these defaults, we have kind of predefined, implementations for these operations. It's clear, however, that, you know, in order to get a useful definition for any given type, such as expert, we need to at least define one of these two guys in a type-specific manner. Anyway, so here's another example. So this is the show clause. This is also a clause from the Haskell library. It's basically the kind of clause that deals with the toString of .NET or Java, right? So given a value, we turn it into a string. So basically, you know, we represent terms in their prefix form here, you know, given a const, we output the string const plus the string obtained from the argument of const, and likewise for addition, right? So this is another example that shows you kind of straightforward way of using type clauses. So the interesting thing is if you use type clauses in your program, then suddenly also your types, of all the expressions and all the functions that you're using in your program will reflect on this. So, you know, if you, for example, in a Haskell session, if you're looking at the type of equality, then this type actually reveals that this is not a generally, you know, universally polymorphic operation, but it is an operation that is constrained, you know, with regard to the type plus eq. So yes, indeed, I have kind of shown here the contrast by means of a, you know, a universally polymorphic function, the identity function. You know, it takes an A and returns an A, right? And there's no constraint on the A, so you can use ID on any possible type. Whereas, you know, quality, you cannot use it on any possible type. Rather, you know, this type needs to be an eq type, right? So this is how we see that sometimes our type parameters and types are constrained by this sort of syntax, right? Okay, so let's actually look at a slightly more interesting example. So this is the filter function, you know, this higher order list processing function that you might have seen before, and one application of the filter function. So the filter function itself is totally polymorphic, right? So again, there are no constraints on A here. How do we read this? Well, the filter function essentially takes a predicate on A, and then it takes a list, and then it returns a list. And the idea is that it filters out all elements of this input list that satisfy this predicate, right? So this is a polymorphic function. It's parametrically polymorphic. Now we sort of instantiate filter, actually form an expression over filter. Namely, we instantiate it in a way that we get a filter function that filters out all elements that are, you know, not equal to a certain given element. And because we are using non-equal here in this expression, well, the type of the expression also reflects that, because we now have a constraint here that says, you know, this is a function that takes an A, namely the A, you know, to filter here, and it takes a list of A's and it returns a list of A. However, the type A must be an instance of the eq class, okay? So the next topic then shall be to sort of compare indeed type classes with C-sharp or Java-like interfaces. That's pretty interesting. So let's start with the simple table. You know, I mean, it's generally interesting to compare, like, you know, Haskell language concepts with, say, C-sharp language concepts. So if you do this, you know, if you start from the C-sharp side, then you might say, OO classes, is there any language concept in Haskell that corresponds very clearly to OO classes? Well, the answer is no. There is no kind of OO class concept in Haskell. In particular, it doesn't make sense to say, you know, algebraic data types are like OO classes, because, you know, they don't really offer the kind of encapsulation that you have with OO classes. So, no, there is no OO class kind of concept in Haskell. But if you look at interfaces, so the idea, you know, that you can provide signatures of operations for some data, that works. I mean, there is a correspondence here, namely type classes serve this role in Haskell. So in the same sense as, you know, interfaces may have some members, type classes have members, right? And in the same sense as you can, you know, implement an interface in your OO program, you can also instantiate a type class. So this is very interesting. So there seems to be a correspondence here. Except that, you know, if you want to say, you know, Haskell's type classes are sort of interfaces, then what this lecture will show is that then they are actually pretty generalized interfaces. So there are some means of expressiveness here that really go beyond what you can do in C-sharp or Java. So let me just point out the most important issues here. Like, the first thing is, you know, the type class instantiation mechanism is sort of retroactive in the sense, you know, there's no strong tie between, like, the declaration of a data type and the instantiation of a type class. You know, we can do the declare a data type in one module and, you know, implement a type class in another module. So this doesn't work like that with interfaces in C-sharp and Java, right? When you design a class, you have to reflect on what interfaces you might need to implement in the class, and you have to do it right away in the class. So it's not retroactive, right? So then another thing is, we already saw this with the Eek class very clearly. With tech classes, you have an explicit reference to the instantiating type, right? Because there is a type parameter, right? And because there's an explicit type parameter, you can refer to it. You can use it in the function signatures of the members of the type class. There's no such explicit referencing mechanism with C-sharp or Java-like interfaces. Rather, everything is implicit. Say, the receiver type or the implementing type for an interface is implicitly there, but you can't refer to it. Right? And this has certain consequences, like with equality, this is a sort of a binary method. You depend on the ability to refer to the implementing type twice. Well, you can't do that unless you have explicit references. And also, when you think about static methods, a static method doesn't use the kind of the implementation type on the receiver position. Rather, it wants to use it on the result position. So again, unless you can refer to the type, you can't express it. So, okay, so I will illustrate these fine points a little bit more. And then we have seen that we can do default implementations of members in Haskell type classes. This is a little bit like, implementing methods in an abstract class, but you can't do that with interfaces in C# and Java. And then yet another very powerful issue is multiple type parameters. So we can even define type classes that have multiple type parameters, so that we don't have anything like the notion of a receiver type. No, we have actually multiple type parameters, and we will look into this a bit more later. But you just get an idea for the generality of type classes through this. And here's some illustration of how you can think of type class members as certain kinds of methods in the terminology of interfaces for all languages. So I've chosen here show, read, and equality. And yes, so the idea is, show is really the, illustration of an instance method, from an OO point of view. In a sense, it takes an A. So basically, this type A, this implementing type A, is the type on which we want to dispatch. So it's really kind of an instance method, right? But then if you take the counterpart, the read operation, A occurs in the result position. It doesn't occur in the argument position or in the receiver position. So, therefore it makes sense to call this a static method. And because we can implement read with type classes, you can see that we can deal with static methods in type classes, but we can't deal with static methods in C# and Java interfaces. And here we have again the type of equality, and you see how we really depend on the fact that we can refer to the type parameter of Eek twice in order to come up with a precise type for equality. Namely, we can model the fact that we really want to compare just apples with apples and no other fruits, right? Okay, so this is also what people call binary methods in all programming sometimes. Anyway, so this gives us a good kind of head start on comparing, interfaces and type classes. So remember again what it means to solve the expression problem. It means that we can do data extensions and operation extensions. And we convinced ourselves that operation extensions are straightforward in Haskell, any functional programming language, because it's easy to define new functions in the functional language, right? So the hard part is to do data extension in a functional programming language. And so data extensibility is difficult because, like the standard algebraic data types of Haskell and other programming languages in the functional paradigm, are closed. So we need to open up data types. So we need some encoding scheme to get open data types. And this is what type classes will provide us with. And then remember, it's not enough just to be able to have new data variants, say to have an open data type. No, we also need to sort of open up functions, because the functions, whenever there's a new data variant, the existing functions also need to pick up this new data variant, right? So we need open data types and open functions. So let's start from the closed situation. So this is the closed data type again for expressions, as we have seen before. So you should just, you know, memorize that there's like two constructors, and you know, one of them adds recursive. Okay. This is the function for which we want to achieve data extensibility. But this is, of course, to start with, this is the closed version of it. So this is the evaluation function. It performs pattern matching on the expression forms. It performs recursion whenever we hit a, you know, sub-expression, that's an expression again. Okay, so this is the kind of the reference implementation, except that it's not extensible with regard to data variants, right? So we need to open it up. So here is how type clauses help us to come up with open data types. Okay, so this is a certain scheme. So let me explain this scheme in all detail, right? So what we do here is we basically start from the closed data type and we take its constructors and we basically define one data type per constructor. So now you see there are like distinguished data types, const and add here, with the same constructors as before, but there are two distinguished data types. So there's one data type per original constructor. And then in those locations where, you know, the constructor had recursive constructor components, we actually factor them out and we have type constructor parameters here. Okay? So this is just the inscoping scheme that we use. So there's one data type per original constructor. And then the second part of the encoding scheme is to use a type class to actually model the original data type. So we had an algebraic data type expert. Now in order to make it open, we replace the algebraic data type expert by a type class expert. Okay? And then we have to say, okay, what types are expression types, and there are these types here, const types and add types, and so we have two instances, right? So again, we have one instance per original constructor, okay? And then, because add types are recursive again, we need to add appropriate constraints here, so that we say, you know, if you form an add type from two other sub-expression types, L and R, please make sure that these sub-expression types are also expression types, right? So this is what the constraint says. So this is the scheme to define an open data type. So what's remarkable about this definition is that there are no type class members involved. You see there are no type class members here. And why is that? Well, this is simply because you know, we only want to model the data type. We don't yet want to model any operations. We don't want to anticipate any operations here. So this will be the next step to define operations on top of this data type. So this is the data type only, okay? So here is the beginning of the open function for evaluation. So it's going to be an open function, so we can't expect to see a regular, you know, function here. Rather, we use a function that is a type class member. So we designate a type class evaluate to the evaluate function. So previously, we had expert here, right? The closed algebraic data type expert here. Now, we are polymorphic in the type here, but we constrain the type to be an expert type, right? So this is how we go from the closed function signature to an open function signature. Okay, so now here's the rest of it. Here are the instances for the type class evaluate, and obviously there are two type class instances because we have, you know, two expression forms. And so, you know, if you first just look at the definitions, you know, evaluate applied to const I equals I, evaluate applied to NLR, you know, recurses into L and recurses into R and performs addition. So these are exactly the definitions as we had them before in the closed model, you know, where we had equations. So the only difference is here that now these definitions are not just a plain list of equations, but rather they are integrated into the system of instances, and these instances make sure that these definitions apply to the appropriate expression forms. Okay, and then because we recurse on the sub-expressions here, we have to make sure that also the types for the sub-expressions are such types for which we can actually perform evaluation. So you see again we have constraints here in these instances. Okay, now we basically have solved the expression problem. Say we have open data types, we have open functions, and so we can define any number of open functions. So we have solved the expression problem, but let's just illustrate that we can indeed perform data extension in such a setup. It's very easy, it's three steps. We first need to come up with a new data type whenever there's a new data variant, right? So we want to have negation. Okay, so we define a new data type neg, and with a constructor neg, and because it's a unary expression form, we have to parameterize over the sub-expression type, right? So, and yes, we actually constrain it here, that it's really an expression type, and then we register this data type with the type class for expression forms. We say, yes, negation indeed is an expression type. And then we say, well, let's see what operations are around. Well, we have an operation evaluate, and so we, instantiate, evaluate for negation, and then we just implement evaluation for negation as we would do this in the closed model too, so there's nothing special. Okay, so this is cool, we really have solved the expression problem. We could think of other operations, and I will show you some other operations that are fundamentally different from pretty-printing and evaluation. And if we want to also have extensibility for some different kinds of operations, we need additional mechanisms. So this is what I will do here. I will show you like two mechanisms based on type classes that allow us to deal with additional forms of operations. Okay, we will look into multi-parameter type classes. You know, so far like eat, evaluate, expert, show, all these type classes we have seen so far in this lecture today were single parameter type classes, right? And so we will need multi-parameter type classes for certain kinds of operations when they should be extensible. But there's a very nice conceptual way of understanding multi-parameter type classes. How can we think of single type parameter classes? Well, they are essentially sets of types with common operations, right? So if you think of eek, what is eek? Eek is a set of types, namely those types that implement equality, right? So now, what is a multi-parameter type class then? Well, these are relations on types with common operations. So you see there's really a generalization going on here, that's interesting. Anyway, so this is the programming scenario that I want to use here. It's going to be about shapes rather than expressions, but who cares? And so shapes, I mean, we have like rectangles, circles, squares, and ellipses. And we want to deal with the operation of intersection. So we want to check whether, let's say, two given shapes intersect. This is the operation that we want to deal with. And this operation is particular insofar that it deals with two shapes rather than one shape. You know, pretty-print and evaluate before dealt with one expression, and that was actually a real limitation that made our life easy. So now intersection is an operation that deals with two shapes, say with two entities of the presumably extensible data type. Okay, let's look into the closed model first, and then let's see how we can generalize to an open model. So here's the closed data type for shapes, right? So we have squares, we have rectangles, we have circles, we have ellipses, and you know there are appropriate constructor components here, like squares and other shapes have some coordinates, and you know a square is a length, and so on and so forth. So So this is the closed data type for shapes, and it's not appropriate if we require extensibility, but it's good for understanding. So here's the closed function, the classical function for intersection, I mean a sketch of it, right? So you see, our function intersect is supposed to take one shape and another shape and return a bool. And then what happens is, we have a list of equations here, I mean, that they perform pattern matching on the two positions of shape here. So basically we exercise all combinations of shapes here, right? We have square and square, but we also have like square and rectangle. And you know, I don't show you the mass here, but you know, we just focus on the code organization aspect of it, right? So there will be more such equations, right? Until we have exhausted all the combinations of forms of shape. Anyway, so the question again is, how do we turn that operation into an open function? Well, we start with defining the open data type, and then I give you the open function. So the open data type looks pretty innocent. You know, what do? We just apply our scheme, which said, you know, you've got to have one data type per original constructor. So we have a square data type, rectangle data type, and so on. And then the second part of the scheme was, okay, you need to come up with a type class for the original data type. Say we now have a class shape where we previously had an algebraic data type shape, okay? And then we provide all these boring instances, and this is how we model the open data type shape. Okay. Now, this is the approach to the open function intersection. And what we do here is we, you know, really exploit the fact that type classes can have multiple type parameters. And we do need this ability for very obvious reasons. Because look at how intersection should be defined on open data types. Well, it should take one shape, and it should take another shape. So intersect, in a sense, needs to be polymorphic in two different types, X and Y, and they are both shapes, but it can be different shape types, right? And so because it's polymorphic in like two types, you know, this type class has to have like two type parameters. Okay, so, you know, now try this with, you know, C sharp or Java interfaces, okay? And then, you know, the rest of it follows very closely, you know, the previous rules that, you know, we basically take the equations of the closed model and turn them into instances. So let's say because there was an equation that pattern matched on square and square, there's now going to be an instance that, you know, instantiates the types to square and square. So there are, again, as many instances as there are combinations of forms of shape. Okay, and I don't show you everything, but you can easily code this up if you like. Okay? So this is the cool thing. You know, we can deal with operations that involve multiple arguments of extensible types. And more importantly, you know, actually we can define the operation by dispatch on these different arguments, because this is what we essentially do here by kind of, you know, defining the actual types. We allow the type class system to dispatch on these types and then to use the appropriate definition, right? So we really have multiple type dispatch with this scheme, okay? So this was one generalization I wanted to show you. And the other generalization is about type classes with functional dependencies. You know, again, I will, you know, bring up another kind of operation that requires more expressiveness than we have seen so far if we want to implement it in an extensible fashion. But also, again, there's a nice conceptual view to think about functional dependencies, I mean, regardless of syntax. You know, we had said that, you know, single parameter type classes are like sets on types of common operations. Then we had said multi-parameter type classes are like relations on types with common operations. And now with these guys, functional dependencies, we will be able to also express functions on types with common operations. So this is pretty cool. You know, we are used to normal functions, I mean, like, you know, Haskell functions. And now with the mechanism that we have aggregated throughout the lecture, we can actually have functions on types. Okay, I mean, if you find this too abstract, no problem. Let's go into samples anyway. So this is the operation we want to play with. So we stay with shapes, but we want to have an operation that's called normalize. So it's kind of, you know, it takes a shape and it returns a shape. And the idea is, you know, we have normal shapes and we have other shapes, right? So we say, you know, rectangles are not normal, but squares are normal. And we say, like, ellipses are not normal, but circles are normal. So therefore, normalize should behave like this. It should, you know, suppose you are on a paint program and you click on a rectangle and you say normalize, then, you know, you would want to get the square, you know, with the same origin and with the same area. Okay, so we want to implement this operation in an open manner. Mm-hmm. And here's again, as a starting point, the closed definition. So, you know, we take a shape and we return a shape. And so what do? So when we face a square, well, that's perfect. Squares are normal, so we just return square unchanged. If we face a rectangle, rectangles, you know, as a form of shape, are not normal. So we, you know, map it to a square. So I leave out the mass here for computing the components of the square. It's pretty obvious, right? Anyway, the point is, you know, we map a rectangle to a square. If we face a circle, you know, again, a circle is a normal shape, so we just return it. But if we face an ellipse, well, then we map it to an appropriate circle, okay? So this is the closed reference implementation. Now, how do we define this problem in an open manner? Well, let's start by setting up a little bit more tick position here. So we already have, like from the previous experiment, we already have the type class shape, right? The type class of all forms of shape. There are instances for rectangle, square, and so on. Now, we actually define a subclass, normal shape, just to be very clear about what normal shapes are. And so we say, you know, squares are normal shapes, and circles are normal shapes. So, with this additional type class in place, we can attend to the definition of the normalize operation. So normalize, you know, would be like this operation. It's polymorphic in two types, where the argument type is a shape type, and the result type is a normal shape type, right? So we basically try to approach this problem by using multi-parameter type classes. So we have a different argument, I mean, potentially a different argument and result type. So therefore we need two types. So therefore we need two type parameters for the type class. Okay. And then we list instances like those. And they are again systematically derived from the equations of the closed reference implementation. There should be no surprise here. So basically it says, you know, we provide an instance square, square, you know, square for the argument, square for the result. And in this case, the implementation of normalization is the identity function. For circle, similar, right? And then for rectangle, square, well, we have to do the mass, and also for ellipse, circle, we have to do the mass. But these are the instances, right? So square, square, circle, circle, rectangle, square, ellipse, circle. So these are the kind of the, this is the kind of the relational types that we kind of deal with, right? We know that these two types are in relationship through normalization, these two types are in relationship through normalization, and so on. Okay, so this looks like a great solution to the problem. It actually compiles this sort of code, except that it doesn't really work in the way we need it to work. So let's look at this. So we tried at the Haskell problem, we tried to use this function. You know, we say, hey, Haskell, can you please normalize square 1 through 3? And then Haskell says type error. And it's a, you know, it's quite a idiosyncratic type error that I'll leave out here. But what it essentially says, well, it sort of says, I don't know which type class instance to use. I mean, that's one way of putting it. And then you say, why does it not know what type class instance to use? It's pretty obvious it should use this one, because I give it a square, you know, it should use this type class, because in fact there is no other type class here, no other instance here with square on the argument position. So why is that? Anyway, so you're sort of surprised, and so you try a little bit more, and so you try this. So you try, let's force it through. Let's tell the type system, hey, I know the result should be of type square, so does it help you any further? And then the type system says, yeah, sure. I mean, if you even specify the result type, then I know which type class instance to use, and so I can perform normalization. So the result is this, right? And then you are left wondering, why is that? Why do you have to specify the result type here? And you realize, you know, you don't want to specify the result type, because in general, you don't know the result type, right? Because if this is like an arbitrary argument, it's an arbitrary shape, you don't know the result type. You really want the normalized function to figure out the result type, right? Okay, so why is that? Well, this has to do with the type class system making a certain kind of open world assumption with regard to type class instantiation. So let me explain this by means of this hypothetical program. You know, these are our instances that we have seen before, right? These are the instances that we understand and that we want, right? And now let's assume that these are the instances that are in scope, as we are compiling, as you are type-checking this nasty expression, right? We want to normalize a square, and we type-check it with regard to these instances. Well, if we just look at these instances, it would be sufficient to know the argument type square to conclude this. However, the type class system doesn't allow itself to make this conclusion, because the type class system has to deal with the fact that perhaps in a later module, you know, that's the final top of everything, you know, which perhaps imports all this code here, that we might suddenly add this instance, right? We might suddenly say, hey, there's also a way to normalize the square to a circle. I mean, you know, by the definition of our problem, you know, we don't expect to ever add such an instance, because, you know, squares should be normalized to squares, that's it, nothing else. But of course the type class system doesn't know that. So because the type class system has to, you know, be prepared to deal with other instances, it can't sort of just on the grounds of one type here, it can't select the appropriate instance. Because, you know, once someone later, there's another instance, this would sort of change the type of the expression. So this is unacceptable, right? So, I mean, you have to understand that basically in Haskell's type class system, instances are sort of in a global pool. So even though perhaps this part has been compiled without seeing this instance, you know, later on this instance might still then affect, you know, this expression, and that's unacceptable, right? So, you know, therefore it doesn't work. But there's a simple solution to it, and this is the functional dependency mechanism of Haskell. So we can go and add such a functional dependency here, and it reads like this, so bar, you know, just to separate the functional dependency from the rest of the head. And we say, you know, type parameter S1 determines type parameter S2. So what this really is, I mean, let me just be very superficial here. This is sort of a consistency constraint on type class instantiation. So it's, you know, it's called functional dependency because it has been inspired by database theory, right? So what it really says is there cannot be two instances with the same S1 but different S2. So this allows the possibility that there are two instances, for example, for argument type square, but different result type, okay? So if you go back, basically this constraint disallows that this instance would be, you know, possible. You know, if someone later would try to add this instance with the functional dependency in the system, this instance would be rejected by the type system. Okay. Now, because we sort of rule out the possibility of a second instance with argument type square, it's clear to the type system that if we have an instantiation of normalize where the argument type is square, and there is an instance around there with argument type square, it can fully commit to it, and therefore, you know, now it works without specifying the result type. So this is wonderful, no? Okay, so we also have solved this problem. Well, I have a few more riddles for you, but before that, I want to just give a short list of further reading pointers, just in case you are interested, and also to pay some credit to some other people. So there's a thesis Stefan Weir just finished this year. It's about Java with generalized interfaces. So basically, in this thesis, Stefan Weir explains how concepts from type classes can be used to enrich a Java-like language so that its interfaces have, you know, expressiveness comparable to type classes. Okay, then there's a paper by me and Klaus Ostermann where we actually discovered some of these correspondences and some of this expressivity. So if you want to read more about today's lecture, this is one of the sources. And then, you know, admittedly, the way we have achieved open data types and functions here by means of type classes, this involved some fair amount of encoding, you might say, right? So these guys, Loy and Hinze, they actually have introduced some native language support for open data types and functions in Haskell. And then I should mention that Haskell actually has some other language concepts in it, such as type families and things like that, you know, and some of these concepts, they compete with type classes. I will not talk about them today, but you know, you're welcome to go there. And then I should also mention that, you know, the kind of multi-dispatch game and some of the other techniques that we have discussed today, they are not limited to Haskell's type classes, so there are other languages with similar constructs, like classical C++ can do things like that, and also the contemporary C++ with the proposed concepts extension. And there's specifically some seminal work on multi-dispatch in an OO context, multi-Java. Well, I could go on forever, but you know, there's lots of related work, lots of interesting stuff out there, but here are just some pointers. And so here are the riddles with which I want to close the lecture today. And they are basically meant to show you that programming with type classes involves some, you know, non-trivial details. And in particular, some of these riddles deal with, you know, the issue of open data types and open functions when they are achieved through type classes. And so you're welcome to scratch your head over those riddles. Well, the first riddle is about, you know, generic operations. So you might remember from chapter 10 of this book here that there's a deriving mechanism in Haskell that allows you to actually require a kind of generic instances for certain type classes when you define algebraic data types. So if you use this deriving mechanism, you don't have to write yourself equality or show. You rather can generate kind of very uniform implementations for eek and show for these data types. So now the riddle is, how can we implement other generic operations as they arise in our system once and for all? Well, you know, this is sort of a built-in mechanism, and it only knows about, you know, certain type classes. But if you come up with a new type class, how can you teach the compiler or the language so that it can implement more generic operations? So, and this is related to the generic programming style that's also called scrappy boilerplate, and I guess I will talk about this in some other lecture, perhaps. Okay, second riddle, it's about equality. So, you know, we started with equality, and it turns out, you know, actually equality doesn't work for open data types. So why is that? Well, you know, once you have open data types, different values of the open data type can be potentially of different Haskell types. You know, Remember, the const type is different from the add type, right? So because they can now be of different types, this kind of type for each doesn't work anymore. So you're welcome to come up with a generalization here so that we can also perform equality on open data types. Now, data construction on open data types. Well, the thing here is, you know, think of how you apply read, let's say, to int and bool. That works fine, right? These are closed data types. So if you want to read an int, you just say read string and you say give me an int. I mean, use typo notation, like, you know, read colon colon int, or read blah 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 colon colon bool, right? That works fine for closed data types. But it doesn't work at all for open data types. So how would you read an open expression? So you can't say read blah 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 colon colon expert, because expert is not a type, it's a type class, right? So basically, I mean, you have to play with this to really understand this fully, but you know, basically there's no easy way to invoke read for an open data type without knowing exactly the type, you know, the specific Haskell type, say the specific data variant that you want to read in. In general, you want to read any expression. So this kind of, you know, this kind of invocation that you want to read any expression, please figure out how this works. Okay, there's a simpler problem here with type over precision, but it's still very telling, so let me do this. So here we are again in a little Haskell session, right? We have one const expression, another const expression. We have an add expression. And now we look at the type of this expression here. And you see the type is actually surprisingly precise, right? So you would expect something like, this is an expression. No, but what it says is, this is an addition expression with an addition expression underneath and then like three const expressions somewhere. So this is very precise. This is actually, you know, distractingly precise. I mean, in a way, the type resembles the structure of the value. So, you know, the riddle is basically to come up with a solution to that over-precision problem. And here's the final riddle for you. It's basically, again, about the intersect operation that we thought that we had tackled. But now, suppose you want to do intersection not just for like two shapes, but you want to do it for a list of shapes. So you see, this time we take a list of shapes, and we basically, you know, lift the pairwise intersect operation to a list of shapes. And this is the closed model, right? So, like with closed shapes, it's easy to go from pairs of shapes to a list of shapes. So how can we, you know, have the open model, where we can't actually write down this type at all, and, you know, how can we deal with list of shapes in the open model? Well, this is also a tough one. Okay, so that's it. And so this is it for today. As you have seen, you know, there were some riddles, and there's probably some lectures that could come out of these riddles, but I also have other subjects that I'm thinking about, and so hope to see you soon again. Thanks. Bye-bye.